you very much, Gavin. Thanks for letting me give this talk. Again, it's all it's the first time I've aired any of this, so I'm ready to be, well, not shouted down, but criticised or comments or any. There's a few areas I touch on that I'm slightly outside my area of expertise. So if anyone notices anything, please let me know. It needs correcting. Now, what I'll just sort of quickly recap on what I went through last week. I looked at an early corpus of texts on Hatha Yoga, and I hope one here. I hope I established that there's no mention or suggestion of a Nath order in any of those texts, nor did any of those who were later included in the Nath Sampradaya write any of those texts. The texts of the corpus are against sectarianism and make very few references to any particular Sampradaya, but there are suggestions in texts such as the Shiva Sanghita and Dattatreya Yoga Shastra of a fledgling Dasnami Sannyasi order. I also noted that there seemed to be two types of yoga, one associated with a Muni, sort of great tradition, more orthodox tradition, which emphasizes asceticism, celibacy, and liberation, and the other associated with a Siddha tradition, emphasizing siddhis and using kundalini in its practice, whereas the other traditions more the breath, focusing on the breath. Okay, so having established that, I then thought, so where are the Naths? Where did they start? And wanted to look for them. First of all, well, I established that they weren't, there's no mention of them in those Sanskrit texts and any other vernacular texts before 1450. There's a couple of vague mentions which I'll come on to. So then I knew where to look for them. And obviously my main source is textual sources. So I'm looking for the words. I'm looking at Nath or Natha. And then there are a couple of other words that have often been equated with the Naths, thought to mean Naths. That's Siddhas and Yogis. So I'll have a quick look at those three words and see how far they could get me. So I started looking at later works, which mainly for the period 15th, 16th centuries, mainly Hindi, medieval Hindi works and some other vernacular texts. And I think I showed last week how in the few instances of the word Nath in the Hatha Yogic corpus and also in the Gyaneshwari, the Marathi work, it normally means Shiva. And in the medieval Hindi works, it has the same meaning, although the god being referred to is not always Shiva, but sometimes there's the sort of Nirguna absolute, but Nath almost always has that meaning. And there's quite a good illustration of this, I think, in the first, actually I've got this one here, in the first verse on the handout, which is a verse from Sundardas. Imre's not here, is he? Hoping you might help me out, but this one's all right. There's a couple of other verses which I'm not 100% sure with. But Kan Farike Basam Lagai Yogi Kiao Sarira Sakal Biapi Nata Najanyo Janam Gamayo Hira. So the yogi makes his body by piercing his ears, Kan Farike, and applying ash, Basam Lagai, to his body. But he doesn't know Najanya, the all-pervasive Nat, Sakalbiyapi Nat, and he wastes his life, that the diamond that is his life, Janam Gumayo Hira. and there are many, many instances of Nat in this sense in the medieval Hindi corpus. It also occurs in the compound Navnat, nine Nats, and a few occurrences, not that many. At this point, it seems that the nine Naths, although they later get identified with nine human Naths and are said to be human gurus, at this point they're semi-divine beings rather than human gurus. For example, in the Guru Granth Sahib, the nine Naths are mentioned a few times, and also it has a few lists of semi-divine beings, and these include Siddhas, Peers, Suras, meaning gods, and Buddhas or Buddhas. And Naths are included with them, but Naths are never included in the many lists of the religious professionals contemporary with Nanak and his descendants. And these lists include quite a lot of them. There's Jogi, Sannyasi, Jati, meaning Jain monks, Jangamas, Siddhas, Tapis, Brahmacharis, Avadhuts, Sadhaks, Munis, Digambaras, Vaishnavas, Qazis, and Mullahs. So, but no mention of Nats in that list. So the earliest usage, clear-cut usage of Nat to refer to a particular type of ascetic that I found is in the Siddhisiddhanta Padati, where in a list of sort of fivefold metaphysical understandings of the world, you get to, I think this one's on the handout as well, Guru Kula Santanam Cheti Panchadha Proktam, Ayi Santanam, Vileshvara Santanam, Vibhuti Santanam, Nata Santanam, Yogishvara Santanam, Cheti Esham Api Santananam, Pratak Pratak Vaishishtyam Vartate. So the traditions, the lineages of the Guru families are said to be fivefold. There's the Ayi lineage, the Vileshvara lineage, the Vibhuti lineage, the Nata lineage, and the Yogishvara lineage. And of these, each of these lineages has its own defining characteristic, its own speciality. But other than that same period, I've not found anything similar. And even in there's a commentary to the Siddhisiddhanta Padati, which is 18th century, and it doesn't seem to, particularly with this Nata Santanam, it just makes out that a Nata is someone who's achieved various sort of saintly qualities rather than identifying it as a particular living tradition. Whereas the other ones, the I Pant still exists. All the other four are occasionally, and some of them very often, like the I Santanam, included in the 12 Pants of the yogis, of the Goraknathis, which I'll come on to later. But after this, I found no instances of Nata being used to refer to an order of yogis until the early 19th century, in a text called the Adesha Padavyakya, which I've looked at as a manuscript in Jodhpur. Adesha is the word with which the Nats greet one another. So that's an exposition of that word. And it's sort of proclaiming the greatness of the Nata Sampradaya, particularly in reference to various texts, which it says are products of the Nata Sampradaya, earlier Sanskrit texts. And then in a commentary on the Hatha-pradipika by Brahmananda called the Jyotsna, which was written in 1843, he also mentions the Nata Sampradaya. And prior to this, in works which were products of the Sampradaya which was to become the Nat, such as the Goraksha Siddhanta Sangraha and the Siddhisiddhanta Padati, which are probably from around 1600, the tradition is called that of the Avadhutas or Siddhas. And both those words have, well, I'll come on to Siddha briefly, and Avadhuta, I was thinking I should have perhaps gone into that a bit more, but that's also a very broad, that's a very broad reference. Lots of sects refer to their members as avadhutas, and it's quite an old term for an ascetic. I think in Patrick's, some of his works on classical sannyasis, they're divided into various categories, one of which is avadhuta. Now, also, as a nominal suffix, Nata has never been the exclusive preserve of the Nats. The names of many Jain saints bear it, as do those of numerous gods. Kaula initiates added Anandanata to their names. And also in 13th century Maharashtra, we see these lineages of Vedantic gurus whose... Should I turn that off? Vedantic gurus whose names end in Nat. And also there's a famous Siddha who I mentioned last week, Baba Balaknath, who has a temple in Himachal Pradesh, and he's always been associated with the sannyasi tradition, not the Nats. And furthermore, the use of the suffix Nata in the names of figures later included among the Nat gurus is by no means consistent. Often the names appear without any suffix or with suffixes other than Nata. Thus, Goraksha is variously referred to as Goraksha, Goraksha Raya, Goraksha Deva, as well as Goraksha Nata. Okay, so then moving on to the word Siddha, which is sometimes taken to refer specifically to Nats, but it's been used since at least the time of the composition of the Mahabharata to refer to anyone who has perfected him or herself through means such as yoga or alchemy. Matsyendra, Goraksha, and other siddhas, who were later claimed as gurus in the lineages of the Naths, have been included in lists of siddhas and in siddha iconography found across India and Tibet from at least the 13th century. Their inclusion amongst the siddhas does not presuppose the existence of an order of Naths. If it did, then Tibet would be a Nath stronghold, yet apparently there's no tradition of a Nath Sampradaya in Tibet. Yet many scholars have made this assumption. And in a similar vein, many scholars have equated siddhas with Naths. For example, there's a picture I'm going to come on to later of Guru Nanak in the Guru Granth Sahib is said to meet with a collection of siddhas, and a few scholars have said that must be the Naths. So now I'll move on to the word yogi, which obviously has a very broad reference. But the Sanskrit word yogi and its vernacular derivative jogi mean one who practices yoga, and this is how it is usually to be understood in the many texts in which it is found. Within the corpus of early Sanskrit texts on Hatha Yoga too, yogi has this meaning. Within vernacular works and histories in non-Indic languages, however, it refers to a particular type of ascetic of whom the practice of yoga is not always a prominent characteristic. Many scholars have understood yogi or jogi in this sense to refer specifically to a Nath ascetic, but until the 16th century, and often in later times too, it had a wider referent. So to this day, any ascetic who practices Hatha Yoga will happily refer to himself as a yogi, and in some cases take the honorific title Yogi Raj, king amongst yogis. And as an example, this pamphlet I've got here is a book called the Siddhant Patal, which is the sort of ritual handbook of the Ramanandi Tyagis. And within this, they frequently refer to themselves as yogis or jogis. Now, the identification of yogis with Naths has resulted in the Naths being alleged by some to have been the first militarized order of Hindu ascetics, when in fact there is no evidence that the Naths were ever organized militarily in the same way as the other ascetic groups that took shape in the 16th century. In the many reports of military encounters involving ascetic orders from the 16th to 19th centuries, there is no mention of Naths. The Naths have never had an Akhada participating in the processions to bathe at the triennial Kumbh Melas, the displays of military might in which the Akhadas of other ascetic orders take part. And on being initiated, Goraknathis vow not to keep dangerous weapons, and the first Sanskrit text of the fledgling Naths tradition, the Siddha Siddhanta Paddhati, which I mentioned earlier, scorns those who carry arms. And we could go for the first picture here, although you're going to need to... Right, I think it's fairly visible. Turn the lights off. It's going to take a while to warm up, but it's not crucial to what I'm saying yet, so I'll read on and hopefully it'll find its way onto the screen. The event that is the basis of some of the claims that the Naths were the first militarized Hindu order after the Muslim conquest is the battle between two orders of Hindu holy men that took place at Kurukshetra in 1567, and which was witnessed by the Emperor Akbar. There are three accounts of this encounter, in which the combatants are referred to inconsistently. Ahmad and al-Badawi say that they are jogis and sannyasis, whereas Abul Fazl says that both sides are sannyasis, identifying one group as Kurs and the other as Puris. Now, Puri is one of the 10 names suffixed by the Dasanami sannyasis, and Kur is almost certainly a corruption, resulting from Persian orthography, of Giri, another of the 10 names of the Dasanamis. And this identification of Kur with Giri is backed up by in the Dabistan, which is slightly later than the time of this battle. He lists the name of the 10 names of the sannyasis, and one of them is Kur. In the place of Giri, he has Kur. So it seems almost certain that the two parties here, I'll come back to this later on when I go through some more slides. And it's quite hard to see in this one, but that both sides in the battles with sannyasis is confirmed in the picture of the event painted to illustrate its telling in the Akbaranama. None of the many ascetics depicted wears a singi, the small horn, which seems likely to have already become a characteristic emblem of the fledgling Goraknathi yogis. But they are all wearing earrings, and that's something I'm going to return to later. It's going to be hard for you to see here, but I've got some blown up, some more detailed slides of it.
Maybe we could have the lights up.
It yeah, it might help.
Yeah.
Shall I do the...
Probably.
That's better.
It seems a suitable way for sannyasis to act. I mean, over what are they fighting?
They were fighting over bathing, well, more collecting dakshina from the pilgrims, because there's a tank there and it was a festival.
Okay.
And so that's what the fight was over. And then Akbar takes pity on the underdogs and orders some of his troops to get involved. And in fact, I think in some accounts he says he tells his troops to disguise themselves as sannyasis and go in naked, covered in ash or whatever, and then they help the underdogs win the battle. And similarly... in the accounts it seems more over sort of having control of the area so that they can collect the revenue from the pilgrims who are bathing. Now similarly, it's warrior sannyasis who are being rebuked in the oft-cited verse attributed to Kabir, which I think is the next bit on the handout, the third part. It's probably not original to Kabir because it mentions rifles, which apparently didn't arrive until the Battle of Panipat, 1526. But I haven't got the... do my best to translate it. Aisa jog na dekha bhai, bhula phire liye gafilai, Mahadev ko panth chalawe, aiso bara mahant kahawe. Haat bajare labe tari, kacha siddhi maya pyari, kab datai manasi tori, kab sukdev tok chi chori, Narad kab banduk chalaya, vyasdev kab bam bajaya. And it goes on. It means I have never seen such yoga, brother, never seen yoga like this. These bhula, sort of forgetful idiots, wander around carelessly, heedlessly, liye gafilai. They control Chalawai, they control the pant of Mahadev, the sect of Shiva, and for this they call themselves great mahants. Labai tari, I'm not sure what that means, but the heart and bajara is something to do with markets and bazaars, so they're doing their practices in markets and bazaars because they were famous for being bankers. Does someone else does anyone else know what this labe tari must mean?
From lava.
I thought there might be a her missing, but this is from the critical edition, so it looked wrong. But then, so tari?
Tari is like that. Lava tari.
Okay. Okay.
In Hindi, you have the Janika tari.
Okay. And they're kacha siddhas, they're sort of unperfected siddhas, and they're maya pyari, lovers of maya. When did Dattatreya ever break down a manasi, which I think is a fort? When did Sukhdev ever Tokchi Jori, how did I think that? Something to do with them. Tokchi, I think, are gunners. When did Sukhdev assemble a troop of artillerymen? That's it. Tolp, of course. When did Narad ever use a rifle? And when did Vyasadev sound the battle cry? Bam Bajaya. Now, all these four are all gurus. Well, they're all named in the lineages of the Dasanami Sannyasis again, and not in any Nath lineages. So again, but as you say at the beginning, Aisa Jog Na Dekha Bhai, what kind of yoga is this? So they're also said to be yogis, but they're not practicing much yoga. okay. So the words Nath, Sid and Yogi are not much help in trying to identify the early members of the Nath Sampradaya. Nath was not used to refer to the order until probably the late 18th century, and Siddha and Yogi had too broad a reference. Now, as I established last week, until the 16th century, ascetics in North India were a relatively homogenous bunch for whom sectarianism was something to be scorned. And to this day, the four main ascetic orders, which are also the orders whose members are most likely to practice Hatha Yoga, are very similar in appearance and lifestyle. And these orders are the Dasnami Sannyasis, the Ramanandi Tyagis, and then the Udasins, which is a sort of semi-Sikh order that traces its lineage to Sri Chand, one of the sons of Guru Nanak, and then the Nats, of course, is the Nats. And to the layman, there is little to tell them apart. Naked or nearly so, smeared in ash and wearing jutta and beard, they sit by their smouldering dunis day and night, some smoking cannabis incessantly. Many of their traits are ancient. Some, such as the chillum smoking and keeping of a dhuni, are more recent, probably learnt from Sufi orders, but most are found across the board. Now, the various different orders retain what might mistakenly be considered as Nart features, but which are in fact traces of their shared lineage, shared heritage. Thus, certain Dasnami Sannyasi suborders trace their lineages to Gorakhnath, and all 27 of the Muri divisions of the Giris, one of the 10 names which I mentioned earlier, have names ending in Nath. And similarly, the Vaishnava Ramanandi Tyagis, besides having the same lifestyle as the Dasnamis and Naths, retain in their liturgy some ostensibly Nath features. This text, again, the Siddhant Patil, mentions, and it's attributed to Ramanand, whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. I mean, it seems unlikely, but the Hindi is fairly old. And it mentions the nine Nats and the 84 Siddhas several times. It also mentions the Singhi, which is the thread that the Nats wear. Sorry, the Singhi is the horn, and the Sali is the thread. It also mentions a thing called a Gorakh Danda, which I've never seen, I don't know if anyone has, which is some... there's a 19th century commentary which explains it as some sort of circle which has thread going across it, and there's a special trick to undoing it. And apparently, if you can, the ascetics who carry this thing, they know the trick of undoing it, and they also, and that's because they know the trick of getting themselves out of samsara. And it's become the Gorakh Danda is a sort of a byword for anything very difficult, I think, still used in Hindi occasionally. As I mentioned before, in the same work, the ascetic is often referred to as a yogi or jogi. And in both its lists of the original dhunis, or sacred fires, in which the dhunis are named after the siddhas who first kept them burning, there are dhunis called Goraki, i.e. the dhuni of Gorakh. And yes, a manuscript bundle in the Maharaja Man Singh Pustak Prakash in Jodhpur, which consists of 61 Hindi works on Hatha Yoga, is the product of a Vaishnava sect, but it was copied by a Vaishnava sect, possibly the Ramanandis. It opens with praise of Ram, Gorakhnath, Dayal, Ramanand, Kabir and Raidas, and was copied in Sambat 1745 by Rup Das, disciple of Gobindas. And similarly, the Jog Pradipika, which is a Brajbhasha manual of Hatha Yoga based on the long recension of the Hatha Pradipika and composed by the Ramanandi Jayatharama in 1718, is an avowedly Vaishnava text, Sita and Rama as Siyaram, take the place usually occupied by the goddess and Shiva in Hatha Yogic works. But many of the names of the asanas it describes are those of the siddhas now associated with the Nats. But it says Gorakh Anjali, Machandar, Charpat, Gwali Pau, Kaneri Pau, and so forth, Jalandri Pau. And then in a similar fashion, others who were in no way could be said to be Nats worshipped Gorakh as a divinity. In the Hindi verses written by Abd al-Quddus in 1480, Gorakh is one of the names of God, and Nanak as well praises Gorakh as the creator in the Guru Granth Sahib. However, there are some features that distinguish the orders from one another. In the case of the Nats, they are as follows. They are members of a distinct order, which is divided into 12 Panths or subsects. The Panths, for the most part, trace their lineages back to Gorakhnath, who is said to have been a disciple of Matsyendranath. Many, but not all, wear thick hooped earrings in the cartilages, not the earlobes, I'll come on to that, of their ears, and all wear a singhi, a very small horn, on a long black woolen thread around their necks, on which is also found a rudraksha seed and a ring, and they hail one another with the greeting, Ardes. So, now I'm going to look into when these traits came together. You know, having given up on looking for them by name, try and identify them through some of these traits. So the first the first feature I'm trying to identify is finder, or I tried to identify as finder, references to a sect of yogis who follow Goraksha. And the first reference to such an order I've found is in the Murugavati, which is a Sufi romance written in 1503. And it mentions a Gorakhpanth three times. I've found a dozen or so references to Gorakh or Goraksha which predate this, but in these he is either a god or a semi-divine Siddha or Nath, and is worshipped as such, rather than venerated as the preceptor of an order of yogis. The one apparent exception to this is in Gyandev's Gyaneshwari, which is written in 1290. And in the list of his gurus is mentioned Goraksha Raya. The first is Shiva, then Matsyendra, then Chaurangi, then Goraksha Raya, then Geheni Nath, and then Nivruti Nath, and then himself. So people have, you know, identified this as a, and they've dated Goraksha from this, and thought that it must be a true lineage. Although, I mean, Matsyendra can be dated to before 900, the original Matsyendra. Shiva obviously is, because I don't think he's named as Adinath. He's actually named as Shiva in the list. So it seems to be a fairly, a legendary, a mythical account of his gurus. And again, the two gurus close to him, the Nivruti Nath, who was his elder brother and his guru, and then Geheni Nath, who was his brother's guru, they, because of their names Nath, this has been seen as the first mention of the Nath lineage. But what stands out to me is the fact that the gurus who are meant to have become Naths are the only ones who don't have Nath on their name. And also, if we look at it, there's a contemporary of Gyaneshwari called Mukunda Raja, who wrote a couple of texts, the Viveka Sindhu and the Paramamrita, which are both Vedantic works, absolutely nothing to do with what we might associate with the Naths, and all his gurus were also called Nath. So it appears that the Nath tradition then in Maharashtra was more a Shastric Vedantic tradition. And furthermore, after this point, there's no evidence for anything that we would imagine might be a Nath order for 500 years. So seems spurious to me. And prior to 1500, there are numerous semi-historical accounts of meetings between Sufis and yogis, but these make no mention of different orders of yogis, and none names Goraksha until the Hujjat al-Hind, which some date to 1400, but others to as late as the 17th century. In the Murugavati, the members of the Gorakhpanth are called yogis, and yogis are distinguished from other ascetic orders, including Jungamas, Tapsis, Jatis, and Sannyasis. After the Murugavati, we find several other 16th century works which distinguish yogis from other ascetic orders as being disciples of Gorakh, and the accoutrements of the yogi are often described. Among such texts is Muhammad Jayasi's Padmavati, in which yogis are said to have received teachings from Gorakh and are distinguished from a large number of other types of ascetic. So this is on the handout as well, the second last. We've got Koi Rikeshwar, Koi Sannyasi, Koi Ramajan, Koi Masavasi, Koi Brahmacharya Panthalage, Koi Digambar Achahi Nange, Koi Sarasuti Sid Koi Yogi, Koi Nirasa Panthabeta Biyogi, Koi Maheswar Jangam Jati, Koi Ekparke Devi Sati, Sevara Kevara Bana Parasti, Siddha Sadhak Avadhut. Not sure what happens to the meter at the end there. So some are Risheshwaras, whatever they are, lords of Rishi, some are Sannyasis, some's a Ramajan, so that's possibly a fledgling Ramanandi, some's a Masavasi, which I'm not sure what that might be, some are Brahmacharis, some are Digambar Nange, which I think probably is perhaps the forerunners of these guys rather than Jains, because I think we mentioned Jatis are mentioned later on, and that's normally how Jain ascetics are referred to in such texts. Some are Saraswati Siddhs, whatever they may be, some are yogis, and some are Niras Pantabetabi Yogi. Not sure who that might be, whether that's even the name of a sect, but there. It sounds possibly like the forerunners of the Udasin, because it's a similar meaning of Udasin, meaning sitting apart, downcast, or something. Some are Maheshwaras, some are Jungams, some are Jatis, i.e. Jain monks, and some Koi Ek Parke Devi Sati, sounds like Shaktas. Sevara is Shvetambaras. Kevara, I'm not sure, it often seems to come with Kevara. I don't know if anyone knows what Kevara might be. And Vanaprastas, Siddhas, Sadhaks, and Avadhutas. So this, in this period, okay, lots of these types of ascetic have older heritage, but we start to see this distinction amongst those who practice yoga. So we've got yogis and sannyasis, Ramanujan, and possibly Udasis, which we don't find prior to this. It's not until the beginning of the 17th century that we find the first references to the yogis being divided into 12 panths. And these are actually found in two Sikh works, the Guru Granth Sahib and the Waras of Bhai Gurdas, both of which were written down very soon after 1600. And in both of them, the yogis' 12 schools are contrasted with the 10 names of the Dasanami Sannyasis. And these are also the earliest references to the Dasanami Sannyasis' 10 names, as reported by Matthew Clark, who recently wrote a book on the formation of the Dasanami Sannyasis. But unlike the Dasanami Sannyasis, whose 10 names seem to have been set in stone, the list of the 12 panths of the yogis varied considerably. Almost no two are the same, and after having recorded 20 or 30 of them, I've just about given up, going on and on. Okay, and I haven't made a note here, but just mention the greeting Ardesa, or Ardesh in Hindi, which the first recorded instance I found of that is in the Siddhasiddhanta Paddhati from about 1600. Okay, now I'm going to move on to the earrings and the horns. Are we all right for time? Oh, fine. right, now, as I said before, we've got a picture here. This is nowadays the Nats, not all of them, but many of them wear these big hooped earrings in their ears, and the guru cuts with a dagger through the cartilage of the ear rather than the ear lobes. There might be a couple more pictures. Ah, my notes aren't coming up. Here's some Nats that I met recently in Jwalamukhi in Himachal Pradesh, where they control a half of a large goddess temple. So you'll see here, there's a bit sort of variety, and there's variety in the materials they use, but they all wear them through the cartilage of the ears. Now there's something going wrong with, should be showing me a different thing here, but I haven't set it up properly, so I don't quite know what's coming next. Okay, well, we're moving on, because earrings are, in lots of the iconography of deities of all sorts, they're often shown wearing big hooped earrings, but always in their ear lobes. Also, kings are often depicted. I mean, I'm no expert in this, but several of the images I've looked at, you show kings, and there's going to be some more pictures coming up from Rajasthan. Rajput nobility often have these big hooped earrings in their ear lobes, and Siddhas as well from Tibet. Now, this is an image from 15th century Tibet, and we've got a close-up here. So as you can see, again, the ear, similar to the Nath earring, but in the ear lobes. I've got a few more here. This one, I think, is 13th, 14th century. I'm afraid I did have notes, which should be coming up on the screen to tell me who these Siddhas are, but unless anyone else can recognize them, I'm not going to remember exactly. I think, actually, this is meant to be Jalandhara, who obviously became famous as Jalandhara Nath in the Nath tradition. So we've got this is from Sri Shailam in Andhra Pradesh. There's a massive wall around the big temple there with lots and lots of carvings, lots of siddhas on there. And again, this is the best image I could get, but the earrings in these ones, a few of them are wearing hooped earrings. This is a close-up of the battle I mentioned earlier, which is described in the Akbar Nam, and there's an interesting quote about the paintings drawn to accompany the account of the Akbar Nam, which in a scholar called Sen wrote about these paintings, that they were almost contemporary with the chronicle and were completed soon after the events they depict, sometimes by eyewitnesses of the events. In commenting on the precision and accuracy of the depictions, she suggests that they may have been envisaged by Akbar as pictorial documents for authenticating history. So they seem, I mean, they are very, very detailed, very useful for looking at all this. So the battle was in 1567, and the painting was probably done in about 1580, 1585. So if we see here, I don't know if you can see, but again, they almost, I think they all have hooped earrings, all in the earlobes. So this is interesting in that the sannyasis at this time were wearing earrings, and it seems to be part of this shared yogic heritage, the wearing earrings, come through the Siddha tradition, like we see the Siddhas are wearing them too. And then about 50 years after this event, it's about 70 years, the Dabistan mentions a battle that took place in Haridwar between Bairagis, i.e. Ramanandis, and Sannyasis, in which the latter were victorious and killed a great number of the Ramanandis, the Bairagis. And the Bairagis threw away their rosaries of tulsi wood, which they wear about their necks, and hung on their perforated ears the rings of the yogis in order to be taken for these sectaries. So again, the Sannyasis seemed still then to be wearing earrings. But nowadays they don't. I think I did meet, there's one particular subset called the Gudaras, which traces its lineage back to Goraknath, and they do, they're reported, and I think I, it was before I was interested particularly in earrings, but I think I did meet one a long time ago, and I've seen some images in the British Library. I was in the British Library a few weeks ago looking at lots of these pictures, and unfortunately I asked for various scans, they haven't arrived yet, but so I had one of these Gudaras with also big hooped earrings. But yeah, this is a picture of a gathering of sannyasis from Mewar in about 1750 at a bandara, and none of them's wearing earrings here. Whereas you can see these Rajput nobles, they're wearing the big hooped. And so it seems that, A, it was a sign of yogis, but also a sign of power in some way, because gods and kings also wore these big hooped earrings. This is another picture from 1740, I think, Mewar II, of a gang of marauding sannyasis. I'm not quite sure what's going on here, but I think they're about to attack the old man and the woman's trying to stop them. But anyway, none of them now are wearing earrings. So it seems that the practice dropped out from the sannyasis. This picture's from 1610. It's in a museum in Jaipur. And these ascetics, they are perhaps heirs to the Goraknathi lineage. They're all wearing these earrings, and they've got these horns around their necks, which I'm going to go into in a bit more detail. I think I've got a close-up of their ears. They're all hooped. It's almost like they're horizontal. I don't know quite how this is working, but through the earlobes. This sort of fancy, oh hang on, how do I get back? This thing around his neck, I've seen that in a few pictures now. I've not seen that referred to anywhere, and I don't know what that's about. It's rather, someone suggested it was strips torn off other people they've been fighting with, but I don't think these guys are fighters. This is from Somnath in Gujarat, 1625, and we've got a couple of yogis here, maybe one here as well with earrings. This one here, he's got the horn around his neck, but no earring. But what struck me when I first started looking at these pictures is that there are no pictures of ascetics with earrings through the cartilage. And in fact, this picture's from 1850. This is an illustration of the discourse between Guru Nanak and the Siddhas. So these are the Siddhas here. He's wearing the typical patchwork coat, and they've got these earrings, but still in the earlobes. Now this is the earliest picture I found. I think I've got a close-up going on. This is from Kishangarh, from 1780 in Rajasthan. If we go in close, it does look like there's been some shift in the location of the earring. It's not conclusive, but there are some contemporary, a little bit later. Now this is a picture of, I think I talked last week about Maharaja Man Singh of Jodhpur, who ruled in the first half of the 19th century. And his claim to the throne wasn't clear-cut, and one of his cousins had the throne, and he was besieged in this fort in a place called Jalore, which is about 50 miles from Jodhpur. And he was about to give in when a Nath guru who was living in the fort with him said, no, wait until the so-and-so day, I think it was Diwali, 3 days before Diwali, and then miraculously his cousin dropped down dead and it's thought he was poisoned, something to do with the intrigues of the Nath. Anyway, so from then on, Maharaja Man Singh became an ardent devotee of the Naths. And this is a picture of Jalandhar Nath, who became his sort of tutelary deity. This is from Jalore this is in about 1805. And that, I just mentioned, there's an exhibition started today or yesterday in London of lots of miniatures and paintings and illustrations and manuscripts from Jodhpur. It's in the British Museum for a couple of months. Some of these pictures I'm showing, I think, in the exhibition. So you see, he's got this. I've got some props. I thought. I'm not sure when I came by this. There's my an earring. I got a couple of the horns, which I'll pass around in a minute. You can see he's got one around his neck as well. One of these horns. Now this is from about 1820 now, on the walls of the Mahamandir, which is this amazing temple which was built for the Naths by Maharaja Man Singh. He gave them this big area on the edge of the city, about like their own self-contained city. And this is another picture of Jalandhar Nath from the walls of that temple. And you see now he's got the earrings through his cartilage. And again, there's a series of 84 pictures of various yogis doing asanas on the walls of the Mahamandir. And again, they've all got the earrings through the cartilage. That's Man Singh worshipping Jalandhar Nath. And again, sorry, you can't really see that clearly, but this is from about 1820, I think 1825. And he's got the big hooped earrings in his earlobes, and Jalandhar Nath now has them through his cartilages. And that's a close-up. That's from an illustration of a manuscript from 1824 of the Nath Charit. I think that's meant to be Jalandhar Nath again. And this one is just, this is illustrating a passage from the same text. From the Siddha Siddhanta Paddhati. And 1824, 1823, illustrating a passage about, or that refers to pranayama. So you can see the singhi with the horn also on this long thread around his neck, and the earrings through the cartilages of the ear. So it seems, this is 1825 from this rather wonderful book that was commissioned by Colonel James Skinner, who's one of those sort of white mogul types, and had some cavalry regiment named after him, Skinner's Horse, and he commissioned a series of, he wanted to depict the different castes and sets, 110 paintings, and this is one of them. This is from 1825, so you see you've got this yogi here with the whistle and the earrings, with the horn. And in the same series is this snake charmer. The snake charmers are also associated with the Naths. There are various orders of snake charmers. And if you see, there's a close-up there, it seems he's also got the same sort of earring. So it seems, within the Hindi works, on medieval Hindi works, so many verses mention yogis and mention what they wear and mention earrings, but only two or three. One of them is that the first verse I quoted mentions the fact that the ears are pierced. But there's nowhere are they derided with this term kanfaka, which became a sort of term of abuse for the Nath yogis. You know, they never use it for themselves, this kanfaka. And that's because the ears are split here. So it seems that also at the time of in the 16th, 17th century, when these medieval Hindi works were generally composed, the word kanfaka doesn't appear in, as I say, there's only a couple of mentions to even ears being pierced. So this could just be ears being pierced, because they need them to wear the earrings in the in the ear lobes. So yeah, it seems like this was perhaps, I'm somewhat, you know, I can't really understand why it would have happened. Perhaps it was a way of establishing the identity more strongly of the Nath order. But at the same time, the sannyasis, for example, seem to stop wearing earrings. Some Ramanandis do, but very few, and they wear these sort of hanging tulsi wood earrings from their earlobes. Okay, now I'm finally going to move on to the horns. Now these really are, because not all Naths wear earrings, but they all nowadays wear this sort of get-up on a black. There's 9 woolen threads, and then I think there's a close-up. Here, and I met this fellow, he was from the Punjab, I met him at Baba Balaknath a month or two ago, and I was admiring his outfit, and so I asked him, I said, is your horn made of crystal then? He looked a bit sheepish, and he wouldn't really answer, so I badgered him a bit more, blastic. but they're made from all kinds of different things, so you can get crystal and gold, and I've got a couple of wooden ones here. I was going to try and embarrass myself by blowing it, because what they do is when they're doing puja in the temple, and then before they eat a sort of ritual meal, not all meals, and I think first thing in the morning, they try and blow them, and it makes this rather strange, squeaky noise. I'll try and blow it. That's about as good as I'm going to get, I'm afraid, but it's not much louder than that when they do it. But when I, again, now the horns are not mentioned in the early Hatha Yogic corpus. There's no mention of horns, but again, there's not mention of many sect markers. But they are mentioned in the Siddhisiddhanta Paddhati as one of the emblems of the Yogi 1600. And the name Singhi, the Hindi name, is derived from, has two derivations, either from Shrunga, Sanskrit Shrunga meaning a horn, an animal's horn, or also they derive it from Singhanada, which means the lion's roar, but it's also used to mean sort of battle cry, which is a bit incongruous with that squeaky noise. But what it's not mentioned in the early works, but there's an intriguing reference to yogis using horns in the 1342 Rela of Ibn Battuta. He says that the yogis were about 50 in number, and a subterranean cavern had been dug for them wherein they lived, and would not come out except to satisfy their needs. They have a kind of horn which they blow at daybreak, at the close of the day, and at nightfall. And then in 1505, a traveller called Ludovico di Vartema met some yogi, as he called them, I think it was on the Malabar coast, and he wrote about them, all generally carry a little horn at their neck. When they go into a city, they all in company sound the said little horns, and this they do when they wish alms to be given to them. And a Sanskrit work from Bengal dated to about the second half of the 16th century, called the Seka Shubhodaya, which is a fictitious account of a Muslim sheikh at a Seka overcoming his rivals the yogis and Brahmins for the king's patronage, tells of the yogi Chandranatha being awoken from his meditation by other yogis blowing their shringas. So it seems that in the past they probably weren't quite that small. In fact, some of the... Let's see what I've got here. Ah, yes, well, I should have gone back to this earlier, but in a horn made of human bone, human thigh bone, is a sort of traditional accoutrement of a siddha in the Tibetan siddhas. And also there's a picture, I'm afraid I can't remember the names of these fellows, it was quite obscure to me. And also an antelope horn is depicted in some of these pictures. Now these horns are obviously considerably bigger than the small ones here, and it's almost like these have become just a sort of ritual symbol, and their original use is no longer, not used in their original use. Back to the Akbar Nama painting, none of the sannyasis are carrying them, although we have got this one up in the top right corner who's blowing quite a big, looks like an antelope horn or something. Again, this picture from 1610, the horns are a bit bigger. There were quite a few pictures I saw in the British Library from the same period, and some of them the horns are hanging on their chest and about sort of that long. So it seems that they've shrunk, and that maybe in the past they could be used for making a more significant noise. We had this picture before with the horn around his neck, and then the Jalandharnath's horn. Now the Jodhpur ones are quite interesting because, okay, they've got quite small by now, but the threads seem to get longer suddenly and start being worn over the shoulder in imitation of a sort of Brahmanical janeo. And the Nats at this time did apparently get some sort of rather high caste pretensions to go with their newfound status. So they forbid widow remarrying, and they wouldn't eat with people they used to eat with, and that kind of thing. So it's almost like it seems to get longer in Jodhpur. Where the Rudraksh and the other bits, as one of these little wooden rings goes with it as well, in the modern pictures, where they come from, I've no idea. There's no evidence of them until in Briggs' book on the Nats from early 20th century, it does figure in those pictures, his pictures. I think this is
sure
the last...
They have their own tradition of that.
Of where they come from? Yeah. Of the horns? Yeah, there's...
The horns, the rings, the rudraksh.
They do, but there's so many different ones. It's hard to filter them out from what the truth is. But yeah, you're right, there may be some truth in some. But this was interesting. This was at the temple of Baba Balaknath. I went a couple of months ago. And he's a sannyasi. He's a not hereditary, but there's a long lineage of sannyasis. He's been in control of this Baba Balaknath temple. And they wear... His is gold, of course, being a... He goes back and forth from Walsall or somewhere. There's a Baba Balaknath temple in Walsall, apparently. And he's sort of quite an interesting figure. And they in all the sort of tax shops around the temple, they sell these similar things. And any devotee of Baba Balaknath wears one of these tiny horns. And I asked him, I said, surely this is a Nath symbol. And he's like, oh, no. Any yogi can wear a horn. Although they don't use them for anything. It's purely symbolic. So, finally, going back, so it seems that perhaps there was a sannyasi tradition of wearing horns, although I'm a bit dubious about it. It's an oldish temple, and it may be that the sannyasis have successfully erased any evidence of the Nats having been there, but they obviously claim that it's always been a sannyasi temple. Baba Balaknath, there's lots of myths about where he was initiated by Dattatreya, who's the guru of the sannyasis, and that Goraknath wanted to poach him but couldn't, and couldn't get his knife through his ears. But it's hard to sift through all of that and get to any fact. And then the Siddhant Patil, this ritual handbook of the Ramanandis I was talking about before, I've not heard, and in fact I haven't, since I realised this, I haven't been in touch with any of my Ramanandi acquaintances to ask them, but in the very first line of this handbook, it says Sri Om Abjage Sri Guru Ramanand Avadhuta Seli Singhi Junga Langota. So the Seli is the thread and the Singhi is the horn. So it seems that perhaps in the past the Ramanandis used the horns as well, but again, very sketchy. I've not heard of any of them using them nowadays. But what it suggests, the way that the earrings and the horns may have been, well, the earrings certainly were used by other orders, and the horn possibly, and were then given up by them, that as the Nats became established and that these symbols became more associated with them in particular, that the other orders stopped using them. Okay, so that's it for pictures. So I've got just a page of to wrap up, and then we can have some questions. The Nats, or perhaps I should say Goraknathi yogis, came together as an order in the 15th to 16th centuries in North India. It is during this period that we find the first references to an organized sampradaya of yogis who trace their lineage to Goraknath. At this time too, various Sanskrit works on Hatha Yoga were first attributed to Goraknath, and the Hindi works attributed to him were composed. Somewhat ironically, no manuals on Hatha Yoga were written by Nats. The one original Sanskrit text that was written in a Nat Milia, the Siddha Siddhanta Padati, while showing a very close acquaintance with many of the more obscure practices of Hatha Yoga, ultimately scorns them and sings the song of the Avadhuta, who has cast off all cares and needs not undertake any sadhana. The Gorakhvani, on the other hand, the Hindi verses attributed to Gorakhnath, couches its hymns to the ineffable Nirgun Absolute in the esoteric language of Hatha Yoga, but many of its verses are very obscure and need explanation to be understood by the uninitiated. At the same time as the Nath Sampradaya came together, so too did the Dasanami Sannyasis and, perhaps a little later, the Ramanandis and Udasins. The Dasanami Sannyasins and Ramanandis made alliances with more orthodox ascetic orders, respectively the Shaiva and Vaishnava Sampradayas associated with Shankara and Ramanuja, and the Udasins had ties with the Sikh community. The orthodox Shaiva orders, those of the Dundi Sannyasis, were beginning to show an interest in Hatha Yoga at this time, and their recruitment of Hatha Yogis into their fold would have fostered this. Subsequently, various compilations and expositions of Hatha Yogic texts were written by their scholars. Over the same period, the grassroots interest in Hatha Yoga by the Dasanami Sannyasis and Ramanandi Yogis seems to have begun to wane, and there are various possible reasons for this, including a growing adherence to the ideas of Nirguna Bhakti and the ideal of the Avadhuta, who doesn't really need to do anything but sit around by his puni, and also the militarization of the orders. So they had different concerns for a while. They became quite rich in the 17th and 18th centuries, and particularly the Dasanamis, were involved in military activity. And perhaps a desire to dissociate themselves from the low caste connotations of being a yogi. It is telling that of the caste that developed when some members of these ascetic orders became householders, those associated with the Dasanami Sannyasis and Ramanandis had a relatively high caste status, while those associated with the Naths were seen as low caste. This may also be why the Dasanami Sannyasis and Ramanandis were happy to stop wearing symbols associated with the yogis, such as earrings and horns. The Naths, meanwhile, did not ally themselves with any orthodox order. There weren't any that would have fitted the bill. And as a result, they never developed a military wing to protect their interests and didn't have the rigid organization of the others. Their 12 punts have always been very fluid, as have their lineages, and until recently, they have had no universally accepted headquarters. Similarly, their insignia have been open to change, hence the shifting form of their horns and their adopting the Kanfata-style earrings, although the significance of the latter still eludes me. The Naths are thus the true heirs to the anti-sectarianism of the early Hatha Yogis, and their open inclusivity has meant that all manner of people have come under their banner, from snake charmers to alchemists. Individual Naths have achieved positions of power as king's ministers, for example, in Bundela, Jodhpur, Kumaon, and Nepal, but as a whole, the order has never achieved the influence or power of other ascetic orders. This and their associated lack of militarization has meant that they have never been seen as a threat by those other orders. Much of the organization of the Ramanandis and Dasanami Sannyasis can be understood in terms of their antagonism towards one another, but both orders are tolerant of the Naths and even call them in to settle disputes. My Ramanandi informants often talk of the Naths as the Sadhu police. To this day, the Naths exist as they always have done. Rather than being a sect in decomposition, in Eliade's phrase, they were perhaps never truly composed, but were a loose-knit community of yogis with ashrams all over the subcontinent, for the most part attracting patronage through the charisma of individuals. In the past, various different Nath Sikhs have been powerful in relation to the others and seen as the headquarters of certain lineages. These include Dhinodhar in Kutch, Jogi Tila in the Pakistani Punjab, and an ashram in Haridwar and also in Gorakhpur. Jogi Tila is, of course, no longer a Nath Sikh. It's been taken over by Sufis, and Dhinodhar's glory seems to have faded, although I haven't been there to check, but one doesn't hear much of it anymore. And of the remaining two, Gorakhpur seems to be making the stronger claim to primacy, although the Mahants at Haridwar would dispute this. Sadly, the current incumbent in Gorakhpur, Yogi Adityanath, a bodybuilder who espouses a Hindutva that even Narendra Modi might balk at, has just been re-elected as MP for Gorakhpur. In modern India, even the once inclusive and anti-sectarian Naths are not immune to the forces of communalism.
With regard to these pictures, the portrait commissioned by Colonel Skinner is clearly what we would call a proper portrait. there the yogis were wearing the briefest of loincloths and definitely split cartilage. The Indian pictures were much more romanticized, shall we say. They had gold embroidered.
Yeah.
A lot of dress, not just a small loincloth. And there's this tradition of having long ear lobes.
Yes.
So the fact that the earrings went through the lobes rather than the cartilage doesn't really seem significant with in the light of these long earlobes.
Do you not think so? Because now that really is the distinctive emblem of the Nats, or one of them. And the fact that there's no evidence for it prior to... I mean, sure, if it was only a handful of pictures, but I've looked at 30, 40, 50 pictures of yogis from the 17th century.
But the long earlobes isn't actually a human trait. It's an artistic convention. And once you've got that, that's the place to put earrings. It seems to be... I mean, Jesus is always depicted with nails through the palms of his hands, despite what all historians tell us about that. That's just not the way it was. It's all icons show him like that. So I don't know if people really take it as gospel.
What, you think the pictures aren't reporting the truth? Is what you're saying? You think they may have been through in the Khan Fata style?
If that's the tradition, then I would think that was the tradition, yes.
The oral tradition, do you mean? Because it just strikes me that there's quite a large body of evidence, and there's no...
Except that it's all this artistic convention style portrait style of Skinner's commission.
Yes. There are the ones from Jodhpur as well, which are very much in the courtly style, and they do show them in the...
Well, it's just a suggestion.
That's what I thought originally. I thought that the artists might not care, but then particularly these Akbar Nama pictures are renowned for their faithfulness. And
yes, but still they have very long earlobes, so they're not faithful to human anatomy.
What, in order to get those hoops in?
Well, they depict figures with these elongated earlobes that most humans don't have.
Yeah.
And once you've got that, it seems to me the place an artist would put earrings.
Right.
Have you ever come across anywhere where when they are initiated, they have to hear the ears?
The Nats do. No, I haven't personally. I have not. I've sort of tried to spend some time with them. And I have spent a bit of time with Nats, but not particularly constructively, I must say. A few of them. I mean, even there, I was reading reports from one of those gazetteers of the central provinces, I think it was, and he's trying to establish the 12 paths, and he says that all the Nats he asks, they generally don't know more than three, and it doesn't get anywhere.
And they have a manual for their initiation. Where exactly the priestess?
Well, they have a period. There's a sort of a preparatory period when they're known as Oghurs, and some of them just stay like that forever and never get their ears cut, and then others they go on for a sort of higher initiation.
And others do it.
Yeah.
So before they're fully fledged, they have to have that piercing.
You can't generalize, and there are so many different lineages. There are certain lineages which never pierce their ears. So, you know, it's very hard. That's why the more organized orders, the Ramanandas and Dasnamas, you can sort of generalize a bit more. But the Nats.
The name that they are Tantric Bawa or Tantric Yogi,
Yeah.
The word is hot is a rather not piercing, but you really
explode,
you pierce.
Bombfartige.
Yeah, exactly. So the name is really violent. They have to do it at some point.
Yeah, it looks pretty scary. They're not allowed to go outside, I think. They have to knit plugs of neem in their ears for a month or two until the cuts heal. Mm. Particularly for somebody who's not allowed to see women. Right, that's very wasted during that period.
But that's what I think, that they may have a sort of system that something called the initiation will show them. There's an old system of all the dakinis, they must have the five orders made of bones.
Mm.
So, not new thing. I
Sure.
They can prove who you are.
Yes.
And yeah, the
perhaps a guru slipped and came for the earlobe. And then a new tradition started.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Of course, the Shinye, the Sringa, is from the word horn. Shinga,
yes,
in
course.
Hindi, Bengali, Shinga,
yeah.
Shingi, but then it is But that sort of thing, this is not a rather self-defense which was not necessary after the British rule was established and you are not allowed to have anything more than 6 inches, any sharp thing.
Oh, right.
That was the rule. So then you have to have a diminished things, accepting the Akalis have to have that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Other
questions? I just want to find out whether you have done any work with a lay punt.
No, I haven't, no. No, I've read sort of Gold, the Golds have written lots about them.
Right.
And some of them do wear the earrings as well.
Yes. Some of them do, okay.
Yes, some of the lay.
One of my students is working on women's songs.
There's a whole lot of us in Bengal.
Yes, the Jugis.
There are two names, Nasuni.
Yes, I've been reading about them recently, but it seems as though the ascetic order was never featured or.
Well,
that strongly
earlier on.
Yes, perhaps earlier.
But it is something like they were nearer to the Buddhist practice, etc., and then went into the countries and so on.
Right.
Very earlier on, they became Grihastha, of course.
Right.
But then that was mentioned that they became lower caste.
Yes, it's a weaver caste, isn't
very
it?
Very low caste.
Yeah.
So, very, very different streams.
Sure. No, there's lots of different streams under the banner of the Nats.
These little whistles are interesting too, don't you find? They've got a very definite conventional shape nowadays in all the paintings and the examples you showed us. And thinking along Sanjukta's line of the Buddhist yoginis and so on. The shape reminds me of nothing more than human finger digit. I don't know if there's any connection can be found, but that's what they look like more than anything. They're not horns anymore.
No.
But if there's a small symbolic thing, then
finger digit
is where.
I have a plan to make more inquiries at the, I can go to the Kumbh Mela, and there's another one in April. Now I know what questions to ask.
Yes. Very good, yes. Because last time somebody was showing something about women, and they also, and sometimes you can have to sort of quarrel about how long the dhuni is.
The akhand dhuni. But Haridwar, where there is quite a good centre of the knot, so they figure a bit more strongly at those Kumbh Melas.
A question from Fondo, then Ilana.
Just a couple of comments and a question. Nepal is also a country,
Pashupatina
is this as common as it goes for the Pashupatina from Dal. And in fact, Gorakhnath temple in Pashupatina is thought to be. In mythic terms anyway, the Sajjwana wilderness is a neat terms of Santra Palace.
Okay, is that the one in the Durbar Square in Kathmandu?
No, that's on the top of Gorakhnath Hill in Pashupatina.
Okay.
And just as to earrings, I'm just wondering how much we can use the art historical evidence as a method of dating which Sampradaya has access to claim to either earrings or horns, since I think he's mentioned these things seem to transfer and then these
sure.
markers of power, whether it's high power in a large percent or lack of power in the sense of filter, it was in the snake coming from the picture of Vajradhara, of course, is really very different. That's much more like
right with
fashion, which is a different point in the ear, and possibly a different that you relate it to. Perhaps it's too broad a claim.
Right.
And then my question is, maybe I'm taking the apocryphal myths around Shankara too literally, but certainly the early Akadas, if not the Vaishnava lineages, that are dated to his rallying.
Dated to Shankara's rallying.
Well, early Akadas are dated, but that could be apocryphal myths around Shankara, but certainly I'm very influenced by your work on sort of this period, 6th century, 7th century, 8th century Shankara time, as a time where the Vaisheshika are organized and there's some logic to that, and probably militarization not for some time after, but probably before the 15th century.
So you disagree with Matthew?
13th century. Well, I have to read Matthew's book, I haven't read
it. Yeah, I mean, he goes into that in extreme detail.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I haven't seen that evidence, but certainly we see in some Akadas now, and I don't know, Matthew may, the date of this, but we see past openness again, and openness to women as well.
Now.
Certainly in the Juna Akada, as well as in now.
Sure. No, I mean, I totally agree with you there. All the and the Ramanandis as well. They're all open to all castes, although still caste plays a.
That's
right. But the Juna and presumably the Mahanirvani as well. There. But what I was making the point also was that the caste that then resulted from, how do you say it, domesticated. Sannyasis and Ramanandis were the Gosains, a relatively high caste, whereas the Nath caste, the Jogis, like in Bengal, were all pretty low caste.
In Nepal, Gosains are sort of a mixed caste, and therefore sometimes.
Sure, they're not high caste, but they have some respect.
Mixed.
I'm just wondering, I'm sort of trying to connect this to what you were speaking about last week. We talked a lot about sort of this question of when claims of textual authorship for what I've had the text became sort of consolidated within that, and how that then would fit into what you're saying today about sort of this sort of continuity of anti-sectarianism. It seems sort of like, not necessarily contradictory, but sort of an interesting relationship then, if this anti-sectarian community is claiming authorship.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, this period of the 16th century, which again in this book that Matthew wrote, he goes into it in a lot of detail about how these different identities of how religious identities became more of an issue, and part of that, part of establishing an identity, seems to quite often involve getting your text to go with it. So, I see what you mean in that. My point is that the Nats established themselves as a sort of organized sect order to a much lesser degree than the other ones. When you compare them to the other ascetic orders of the time, whose organization has persisted until now, whereas the Nats, it seems fairly, just almost symbolic. You know, it doesn't actually have any function now, particularly. They have the 12 punts, they have meetings at Kumbh Melas and stuff, but nothing like to the extent of which the Dasnanis and Ramanandis use their organisation.
It's interesting, the earliest occurrences of these kind of external signs. Somewhere in Abhinavagupta in the French Alokya, he talks about I don't know if sure he uses the word yogi, but some of the aesthetics are some kind of having external signs, linga, he uses the word linga, but the real yogis don't use that.
Right.
And I was just quite interested in that.
I think there's a similar passage last week in one of the texts, from the Dattatreya Yoga Shelf as well, talks about the linga thing, I must say, and the wearing of clothes.
Linga, within the aesthetic tradition, need not refer to a linga.
Sign.
I mean, in fact, the bowl and anything that he wears and his scarf, they're all linga.
holders of bones or something. And the other thing I was going to ask, is to an Atabhita. They seem to be yogis without external signs in some sense. And I was interested in that term, because I think in Buddhism it's used for the Sushumna Nadi, if I remember.
Yes, in some of the, maybe in the Siddha poems, Avadhuti, it's normally feminine, isn't it? Mm. But it's very, I mean, it's the one sort of name that all these orders would happily use, I think, for themselves, Avadhutas. You know, rather than, because you know, people, as soon as they see Hatha Yoga, they think of the Nats, and when they look at the ascetics of today, they think that the common features are all Nats. And I'm not sure that's, you know, one can say that, but all these features do come under the rubric of the Avadhuta in the various, all across lots of different traditions. Like I was saying, reading some of Patrick's work recently, from early classical texts across the white, this Siddhant Patil from the Ramanandis in the first line, Ramananda is meant to be an Avadhuta. I don't think that. Sandra, I don't know if you know, the Dasnamis don't use it that much anymore, do they? I don't think. Yeah. But they did. I've read things from the 17th century where the Naga, what are now known as the Nagas, are contrasted with the Dandis, the more orthodox stick holders, and they're called Avadhutas. So yes, it seems to be fairly across the board.
In Buddhism, I think we find it has the significance of without partner, so that Avadhuti central channel is on its own, not like Lalana and Rasana, which partner each other. And in this kind of context, I think an Avadhuta just means Ekavavira, a solitary hero, someone who goes on their own without a household partner. That's how I read it.
Question about these ascetics who are armed, always interested me and I could never understand. Would there be a possibility that there was a coming of two streams of asceticism together? I wonder if you've read Joseph Alter's work on the wrestler's body,
yes.
And that the whole wrestling bodybuilding tradition, which is also Naga, you know, naked. Would there be a possibility that there's sort of these two streams coming together rather than the ascetics themselves arming themselves, which seems rather
bizarre. Yes.
Bizarre, yeah.
That's true. I mean, that's a good point. But then we do get older references to sort of armed Pasupata ascetics. There's in the Brihat Katha Shloka Sangraha, there's a passage comic passage of these rather buffoon-like Pasupatas they're not actually on pilgrimage, but they're on one of these caravans, you know, accompanying one of these caravans, and they're armed, and they're meant to be protecting the caravan, and then at the first sign of danger, they run off into the forest. And that's 9th century or 11th century.
Oh, that's it.